More immediate surprise was that his hands were shaking. He had been going to make a cup of chamomile tea, but when he saw how his hands trembled, he took a bottle out of a cabinet and poured a small amount of whiskey into a glass. Skittish old idiot. But calling himself names did not help, and when he brought the glass to his lips, his hand still shook. It was this damned anniversary. The whiskey, when he took it into his mouth, tasted like diesel oil, and he spat it out into the sink. Poor Edward. Ricky rinsed out his glass, turned off the light, and went up the stairs in the dark. In his pajamas, he left the dressing room and crossed the hall to his bedroom. Quietly, he opened the door. Stella lay breathing softly and rhythmically on her side of the bed. If he could make it around to his side without knocking into the chair or kicking over her boots or brushing against the mirror and making it rattle, he could get into bed without disturbing her. He gained his side of the bed without waking her and quietly slipped under the blankets. Very gently he stroked his wife's bare shoulder. It was quite likely that she was having another affair, or at least one of her serious flirtations, and Ricky thought that she had probably taken up again with a professor she'd met a year ago. There was a breathy silence on the phone that was peculiarly his. Long ago, Ricky had decided that many things were worse than having your wife occasionally go to bed with someone else. She had her life, and he was a large part of it. Despite what he sometimes felt and had said to Sears 2 weeks before, not being married would have been an impoverishment. He stretched out, waiting for what he knew would happen. He remembered the sensation of having the eyes boring into his back. He wished that Stella could help, could comfort him in some way, but not wishing to alarm or distress her, thinking that they would end with every new day and thinking also that they were uniquely, privately his. He had never told her of his nightmares. This is Ricky Hawthorne preparing for sleep. Lying on his back, his clever face showing no sign of the emotions behind it. His hands behind his head, his eyes open, tired, uneasy, jealous, fearful. 2. In her room at the Archer Hotel, Anna Mostyn stood at a window and watched individual snowflakes drift down toward the street. Though the overhead light was off and it was past 12, she was fully dressed. The long coat was thrown over the bed, as if she had just come in or was just going out. She stood at the window and smoked, a tall, attractive woman with dark hair and long blue eyes. She could see down nearly the entire length of Main Street, the deserted square to one side with its empty benches and bare trees, the black fronts of shops, and the Village Pump restaurant and a department store. 2 blocks on, a traffic light turned green over an empty street. Main Street continued for 8 blocks, but the buildings were visible only as dark shop fronts or office buildings. On the opposite side of the square, she could see the dark facades of 2 churches looming above the tops of the bare trees. In the square, a bronze Revolutionary War general made a grandiose gesture with a musket. "Tonight or tomorrow?" she wondered, smoking her cigarette and surveying the little town. "Tonight." 3. When sleep finally came to Ricky Hawthorne, it was as if he were not merely dreaming, but had in fact been lifted bodily and still awake into another room in another building. He was lying in bed in a strange room, waiting for something to happen. The room seemed deserted, part of an abandoned house. Its walls and floor were bare planks. The window was only an empty frame. Sunlight leaked in through 12 cracks. dust particles swirled in these stark rays of light. He did not know how he knew it, but he knew that something was going to happen, and that he was afraid of it. He was unable to leave the bed, but even if his muscles were working, he knew with the same knowledge that he would not be able to escape whatever was coming. The room was on an upper floor of the building. Through the window he saw only gray clouds and a pale blue sky, but whatever was coming was going to come from inside, not out there. His body was covered in an old quilt, so faded that some of its squares were white. Beneath it, his legs lay paralyzed, two raised lines of fabric. When Ricky looked up, he realized that he could see every detail of the wooden planks on the wall with a more than usual clarity. He saw how the grain flowed down each board, how the knot holes were formed, the way the nail heads stood out at the tops of certain boards. Breezes filled the room, flicking the dust here and there. From down at the bottom of the house, he heard a crash. It was the noise of a door being thrown open, a heavy cellar door banging against a wall. Even his upstairs room shook with it. As he listened, he heard some complex form dragging itself out of the cellar. It was a heavy form, animal-like, and it had to squeeze through the doorframe. Wood splintered, and Ricky heard the creature thud against a wall. Whatever it was began to investigate the ground floor, moving slowly and heavily. Ricky could picture what it saw, a series of bare rooms exactly like his. On the ground floor, tall grass and weeds would be growing up through the cracks in the floorboards. The sunlight would be touching the sides and back of whatever was moving heavily, purposefully through these deserted rooms. The thing downstairs made a sucking noise, then a high-pitched squeal. It was looking for him. It was snuffling through the house, knowing he was there. Ricky tried again to force his legs to move, but the two lumps of fabric did not even twitch. The thing downstairs was brushing against walls as it passed through the rooms, making a scratchy noise. The wood creaked. He thought he heard it break through a rotten floorboard. Then he heard the noise he had been dreading. It shouldered through another doorway. The noises from downstairs were suddenly louder. He could hear the thing breathing. It was at the bottom of the staircase. He heard it hurl itself at the stairs. It thumped up what sounded like a half dozen stairs and then slipped back down. Then it went more slowly, whining with impatience, taking the stairs two or three at a time. Ricky's face was wet with perspiration. What most frightened him was that he couldn't be sure if he were dreaming or not. If he could be certain that this was only a dream, then he had only to suffer through it, to wait until whatever it was down there got up to the top of the stairs and burst into the room. The scare would wake him up. But it did not feel at all like a dream. His senses were alert, his mind was clear. The entire experience lacked the rather disembodied, disconnected atmosphere of a dream. In no dream had he ever sweated. And if he was wide awake, then the thing banging and thundering on the stairs was going to get him because he couldn't move. The noises changed, and then Ricky realized that he was indeed on the third floor of the abandoned building, because the thing looking for him was on the second. Its noises were much louder, the whining, the slithery sound as its body rubbed through doors and against walls. It was moving faster, as if it smelled him. The dust still circled in the random beams of sun. The few clouds still drifted through a sky that looked like early spring. The floor rattled as the creature thrust impatiently back onto the landing. Now he could hear its breathing very clearly. It threw itself at the last staircase, making a noise like a wrecking ball hitting the side of a building. Ricky's stomach seemed packed with ice. He was afraid he would vomit ice cubes. His throat tightened. He would have screamed, but he thought, even while knowing it was not true, that if he did not make any noise, maybe the thing would not find him. It squealed and whined, banging its way up the staircase. A stair rod snapped. When it reached the landing outside his bedroom door, he knew what it was. A spider. It was a giant spider. It thudded against the door of his room. He heard it begin to whine again. If spiders could whine, that was how they would do it. A multitude of legs scrabbled at the door as the whining grew louder. Ricky felt pure terror, a white, elemental fear worse than he'd ever experienced. But the door did not splinter. It quietly opened. A tall, black form stood just beyond the doorframe. It was no spider, whatever it was, and Ricky's terror decreased by an unconscious fraction. The black thing in the doorway did not move for a moment, but stood as if looking at him. Ricky tried to swallow. He managed to use his arms to push himself upright. The rough planks rubbed against his back, and he thought again, "This isn't a dream." The black form came through the door. Ricky saw that it was not an animal at all, but a man. Then another plane of blackness separated off, then another, and he saw that it was three men. Beneath the cowls draped over their lifeless faces, he saw the familiar features. Sears James and John Jaffrey and Louis Benedict stood before him, and he knew that they were dead. He woke up, screaming. His eyes opened to the normal sights of morning on Melrose Avenue, the cream-colored bedroom with the graphics Stella had bought on their last trip to London, the window looking out on the big backyard, a shirt draped over a chair. Stella's firm hand gripped his shoulder. The room seemed mysteriously absent of light. On a strong impulse he could not name, Ricky jumped out of bed. Came as close to jumping out of bed as his 70-year-old knees would permit, and went across to the window. Stella behind him said, "What?" He didn't know what he was looking for, but what he saw was unexpected. The entire backyard, all the roofs of the neighboring houses, were dusted with snow. The sky, too, was oddly without light. He didn't know what he was going to say, but when he opened his mouth, he uttered, "It snowed all night, Stella. John Jaffrey should never have had that dead blasted party." 4. Stella sat up in bed and talked to him as if he had said something reasonable. "Wasn't John's party over a year ago, Ricky? I don't see what that has to do with last night's snow." He rubbed his eyes and his dry cheekbones. He smoothed down his mustache. "It was a year ago last night." Then he heard what he had been saying. "No, of course not. There's no connection, I mean." "Come back to bed and tell me what's wrong, baby." "Oh, I'm okay," he said, but returned to the bed. When he was lifting the blankets to get back in, Stella said, "You're not okay, baby. You must have had a terrible dream. Do you want to tell me about it?" "It doesn't make much sense." "Tell me anyhow." She began to caress his back and shoulders, and he twisted to look down at her head on the dark blue pillow. As Sears had said, Stella was a beauty. She had been a beauty when he met her, and apparently she would be a beauty when she died. It was not a plump chocolate box prettiness, but a matter of strong cheekbones, straight facial planes, and definite black eyebrows. Stella's hair had gone an uncompromising gray when she was in her early 30s, and she had refused to dye it, seeing long before anyone else what a sexual asset an abundant head of gray hair would be when combined with a youthful face. Now she still had the abundant gray hair, and her face was not much less youthful. It would be more truthful to say that her face had never been precisely youthful, nor would it ever truly be old. In fact, with every year, up nearly to 50, she had come more completely into her beauty, and then had pitched camp there. She was 10 years younger than Ricky, but on good days she still looked only a blink over 40.
"Tell me, Ricky," she said, "what the hell is going on?"
So he began to tell her his dream, and he saw concern, horror, love, and fear cross her elegant face. She continued to rub his back, and then moved her hand to his chest.
"Baby," she said when he was through, "do you really have dreams like that every night?"
"No," he said, looking at her face and seeing beneath the superficial emotions of the moment the self-absorption and amusement which were always present in Stella and which were always joined.
"That was the worst one."
Then, smiling a little because he saw where she was going with all this rubbing, he said,
"That was the champ." "You've been very tense lately."
She lifted his hand and touched it to her lips.
"I know. Do all of you have these bad dreams?"
"All who?"
"The Chowder Society."
She placed his hand on her cheek.
"I think so."
"Well," she said, and sat up and, crossing her arms, elbows out before her, began to work her nightdress over her head.
"Don't you old fools think you ought to do something about it?"
The nightdress went off, and she tossed her head to flip her hair back into place. Their two children had left her breasts sagging and her nipples large and brown, but Stella's body had aged only a little more than her face.
"We don't know what to do," he confessed. "Well, I know what to do," she said, and went back down on the bed and opened her arms.
If Ricky had ever wished that he had remained a bachelor like Sears, he did not wish it this morning.
"You old sexpot," Stella said when they were done. "You would have given this up a long time ago if it hadn't been for me. What a loss that would have been. If it weren't for me, you'd be too dignified to ever take your clothes off."
"That's not true."
"Oh, what would you do then? Chase after little girls like Louis Benedict?"
"Louis doesn't chase after little girls."
"Girls in their 20s, then?"
"No, I wouldn't."
"There, I'm right. You wouldn't have any sex life at all, like your precious partner Sears."
She folded back the sheets and blankets on her side of the bed and got out.
"I'll shower first," she said.
Stella demanded a long time by herself in the bathroom every morning. She put on her long, white-gray robe and looked as if she were about to tell someone to sack Troy.
"But I'll tell you what you should do. You should call Sears right now and tell him about that awful dream. You won't get anywhere if you won't at least talk about it. If I know you and Sears, you two can go for weeks at a time without saying anything personal to each other. That's dreadful. What in the world do you talk about, anyhow?"
"Talk about?" Ricky asked, a little taken aback. "We talk about law."
"Oh, law,"
Stella said, and marched off toward the bathroom. When she returned, nearly 30 minutes later, he was sitting up in bed looking confused. The pouches beneath his eyes were larger than usual.
"The paper isn't here yet," he said. "I went downstairs and looked."
"Of course it isn't here," Stella said, dropping a towel and a box of tissues on the bed, and turned away again to go into the dressing room.
"What time do you think it is?"
"What time? Why, what time is it? My watch is on the table."
It's just past 7.
7?
They normally did not get up until 8, and Ricky usually dawdled around the house until 9:30 before leaving for the office on Wheat Row. Though neither he nor Sears admitted it, there was no longer much work for them. Old clients dropped in from time to time. There were a few complicated lawsuits, which looked to drag on through the next decade. There was always a will or two, or a tax problem, to clarify, but they could have stayed home 2 days of every week without anybody noticing. Alone in his part of the office suite, Ricky lately had been rereading Donald Wanderley's second book, trying unsuccessfully to persuade himself that he wanted its author in Millburn.
"What are we doing up?"
"You woke us up with your screaming, if I have to remind you," Stella called from the dressing room. "You were having problems with a monster that was trying to eat you, remember?"
Ricky said. "I thought it looked dark outside."
"Don't be evasive," Stella called,
and in another minute or two was back beside the bed, fully dressed.
"When you start to scream in your sleep, it's time to start taking whatever is happening to you seriously. I know you won't go to a doctor."
"I won't go to a head doctor anyhow," Ricky said. "My mind is in good working order."
"So I said. But since you won't consider that, you should at least talk to Sears about it. I don't like to see you eating yourself up."
With that, she left for the downstairs. Ricky lay back, considering. It had been, as he said to Stella, the worst of the nightmares. Simply thinking about it now was unsettling. Simply having Stella go down the stairs was at some level unsettling. The dream had been extraordinarily vivid, with the detail and texture of wakefulness. He remembered the faces of his friends, bereft, poor corpses, abandoned of life. That had been horrid. It had been somehow immoral, and the shock to his morality, even more than the horror, had made him open his mouth and scream. Maybe Stella was right. Without knowing how he would bring up the subject with Sears, he nevertheless picked up the receiver of the bedside phone. After Sears's phone had rung once, Ricky realized that he was acting very much out of character and that he didn't have the faintest idea why Stella thought Sears James would have anything worthwhile to say. But by then it was too late and Sears had picked up the phone and said hello.
"It's Ricky, Sears."
Evidently it was the morning for demonstrating inconsistency of character. Nothing less like Sears than his response could be imagined.
"Ricky, thank God," he said. "You must have ESP. I was just going to call you. Can you come by and pick me up in 5 minutes?
"Give me 15 minutes, Ricky said. "What happened?"
And then, thinking of his dream,
"Did anybody die?"
"Why do you ask that?" Sears said in a different, sharper voice.
"No reason. I'll tell you later. I take it we're not going to Wheat Row."
"No, I just had a call from our Virgil. He wants us out there. He wants to sue everybody in sight. Step on it, will you?"
"Elmer wants us both at his farm. What happened?"
Sears was impatient.
"Something earth-shaking, apparently. Pull the plug out, Ricky."
5. While Ricky hurried into a scalding shower, Louis Benedict was jogging on a path through the woods. He did this every morning, jogging a regular 2 miles before making breakfast for himself and whatever young lady might have spent the night at his house. Today, as always after Chowder Society nights, and far oftener than his friends imagined, there was no young lady, and Louis was pushing himself harder than usual. The night before, he'd had the worst nightmare of his life. Its effects still clung to him, and he thought that a good run would blow them away.
Where another man would write in a diary or confide in his mistress or have a drink, Lewis exercised. So now, in a blue running suit and Adidas shoes, he puffed his way along the path through his woods. Lewis's property had included both woods and pasture, along with the stone farmhouse he had cherished from the moment he had seen it. It was like a fortress with shutters, a huge building constructed at the start of the century by a rich gentleman farmer who liked the look of the castles in the illustrated novels of Sir Walter Scott, admired by his wife. Lewis neither knew nor cared about Sir Walter, but years of living in a hotel had left him with the need for the sense of a multitude of rooms about him. He would have had claustrophobia in a cottage. When he had decided to sell his hotel to the chain which had been offering increasing amounts of money for it over the 6 preceding years, he had enough money left after taxes to buy the only house in or near Millburn which would truly have satisfied him, and enough to furnish it as he wished. The paneling, guns, and pikestaffs did not always please his female guests. Stella Hawthorne, who had spent 3 adventurous afternoons at Lewis's farm shortly after his return, had said she'd never been had in an officer's mess before. He'd sold the pasture land as soon as he could, but kept the woods because he liked the idea of owning them. Jogging through them, he always saw something new, which quickened his sense of life. One day, a pocket of snowdrops and monk's hoods in a hollow beside the stream. The next, a red-winged blackbird as big as a cat, peering wild-eyed at him from the branches of a maple. But today he was not looking. He was simply running along the snowy path, wishing that whatever was going on would stop. Maybe this young wanderleek could set things right again. Judging by his book, he had been to a few dark places himself. Maybe John was right, and Edward's nephew would at least be able to figure out what was happening to the 4 of them. It could not just be guilt after all this time. The Eva Galley business had happened so long ago that it had concerned 5 different men in a different country. If you looked at the land and compared it to what it was in the 20s, you'd never think it was the same place. Even his woods were second growth, though he liked to pretend that they were not. Lewis Running liked to think of the huge climax forest that had once blanketed nearly all of North America, a vast belt of trees and vegetation, silent wealth, through which moved only himself and Indians, and a few spirits. Yes, in an endless vault of forest, you could believe in spirits. Indian mythology was full of them. They suited the landscape. But now, in a world of Burger Kings and Piggly Wiggly supermarkets and pitch-and-putt golf courses, all the old tyrannical ghosts must have been crowded out.
They aren't crowded out yet, Lewis. Not yet.
It was like another voice speaking in his mind. Like hell they aren't, he said to himself, passing one hand over his face.
Not here. Not yet.
Shit. He was spooking himself. He was still affected by that damned dream. Maybe it was time they really talked about these dreams to one another, described them. Now suppose they all had the same dream. What would that mean? Lewis's mind could not go so far. Well, it would mean something, and at least talking about it would help. He thought he had scared himself awake this morning. His foot came down into slush, and he clearly saw the final image of his dream. The 2 men withdrawing their hoods to show their wasted faces.
Not yet.
God damn. He came to a halt exactly halfway on his run and wiped his forehead on the sleeve of the running jacket. He wished he had already completed the run and were back inside his kitchen, brewing up coffee or smelling bacon frying in the pan. "You're tougher than this, you old buzzard," he counseled himself. "You've had to be. ever since Linda killed herself. He leaned for a moment on the fence at the end of the path, where it circled back into the trees, and looked aimlessly out over the field he had sold. Now it was lightly covered with snow, a bumpy expanse from which hard light momentarily bounced and sang. All that, too, would have been forest.
Where the dark things hid.
Oh, hell. Well, if they did, they weren't anywhere in sight now. The air was leaden and empty, and you could see nearly all the way across the dip in the valley to where the trucks on Route 17 steamed on toward Binghamton and Elmira, or the other way toward Newburgh or Poughkeepsie. Only for a moment the woods at his back made him feel uneasy. He turned around, saw only the path twisting back into the trees, heard only an angry squirrel complain that he was going to have a hungry winter. Well, we've all had hungry winters. He was thinking of the season after Linda had died. Nothing puts off guests like a public suicide. And is there a Mrs. Benedict? Oh, yes, that's her bleeding all over the patio. You know, the one with the funny bend in her neck? They had cleared off one by one, leaving him with a deteriorating $2 million asset and no cash inflow. He'd had to let 3/4 of the staff go and paid the rest out of his own pocket. It had been 3 years before business had returned and 6 years before he had paid his debts. Suddenly, what he wanted was not coffee and bacon, but a bottle of O'Keefe's beer, a gallon of it. His throat was dry and his chest ached. Yes, we've all had hungry winters, pal. A gallon of O'Keefe's? He could have swallowed a barrel. Remembering Linda's senseless, inexplicable death made him yearn for drunkenness. It was time to get back. Shaken by memory, Linda's face had come back to him with utter clarity, claiming him through the 9 years since that moment. He turned from the fence and inhaled deeply. Running, not a gallon of ale, was his therapy now. The path through the mile and a half of woods seemed narrower, darker. "Your problem, Lewis, is that you're yellow." It was the nightmare that had brought back the memories. Sears and John, in those cerements of the grave, with those lifeless faces. Why not Ricky? If the other two living members of the Chowder Society, why not the third? He was sweating even before he started the run back. The return path took a long angle off to the left before turning back in the direction of the farmhouse. Normally, this loafing misdirection was Lewis's favorite part of his morning run. The woods closed in almost immediately, and by the time you had gone 15 paces, you forgot all about the open field at your back. More than any other part of the path, it looked here like the original climax forest. Thick oaks and girlish birches fought for root space. Tall ferns crowded toward the path. Today he ran it with as little pleasure in it as it was possible for him to feel. All those trees, their number and thickness, were obscurely threatening. Running away from the house was like running away from safety. Going over the powdery snow and white air, he pushed himself hard toward the cut back home. When the sensation first hit him, he ignored it, vowing not to allow himself to be whammied any more than he was already. What had come into his mind was that someone was standing back at the beginning of the return path, just where the first tree stood. He knew that no one could be there. It was impossible that anyone had walked across the field without his noticing. But the sensation persisted. It would not be argued away. His watcher's eyes seemed to follow him, going deeper into the crowded trees. A squadron of crows left the branches of an oak just ahead of him. Normally this would have delighted Lewis, but this time he jumped at their racket and almost fell. The sensation shifted and became more intense. The person back there was coming after him, staring at him with huge eyes. Frantic, despising himself, Lewis pelted for home, without daring to look back. He could feel the eyes watching him until he reached the walkway leading across his back garden from the edge of the woods to his kitchen door. He ran down the path, his chest raggedly hauling in air, twisted the doorknob, and jumped inside. He slammed the door behind him and went immediately to the window beside it. The path was empty, and the only footprints were his. Still, Lewis was frightened, looking out to the near edge of his woods. For a moment, a traitorous synapse in his brain told him, "Maybe you should sell out and move into town." But there were no footprints. Nobody could possibly be out there, keeping out of sight in the shelter of the trees. He wouldn't be scared out of the house he needed, forced by his own weakness to trade his splendid, comfortable isolation for a crowded discomfort. To this decision made in a cold kitchen on the first day of snowfall he would hold. Lewis put a kettle on the stove, got his coffee pitcher off a shelf, filled the grinder with Blue Mountain beans, and held the switch down until they were powder. Oh, hell. He opened the refrigerator, took out a bottle of O'Keefe's, and after snapping off the cap, drank most of it without tasting or swallowing. As the beer hit his stomach, a two-sided thought surprised him. I wish Edward was still alive. I wish John hadn't pushed so hard for his god-awful party.
6. Well, speak up, said Ricky. What is it? Trespassers again? We explained our position on that. He must know, even if he won, that he couldn't make enough on a trespassing suit to pay expenses.
They were just entering the foothills of the Cayuga Valley, and Ricky was handling the old Buick with great care. The roads were slippery, and though ordinarily he would have had his snow tires put on before making even the 8-mile drive to Elmer Scales's farm, this morning Sears had not given him time. Sears himself, huge in his black hat and black fur-collared winter coat, seemed as conscious of this as Ricky. "Keep your mind on your driving," he said. "There's supposed to be ice on the roads up around Damascus."
"We're not going to Damascus," Ricky pointed out.
"Even so."
"Why didn't you want to use your car?"
"I'm having the snow tires put on this morning." Ricky grunted, amused. Sears was in one of his refractory moods, a frequent consequence of a conversation with Elmer Scales. He was one of their oldest and most difficult clients. Elmer had come to them, first at 15 years of age, with a long and complex list of people he wished to sue. They had never managed to get rid of him, nor had he ever altered his perception of conflict as a situation best addressed by an immediate lawsuit. A skinny, excitable man, with jutting ears and a high-pitched voice, Scales was called Our Virgil by Sears because of his poetry, which he ritually sent off to Catholic magazines and local papers. Ricky understood that the magazines just as ritually sent them back. Once Elmer had shown him a file stuffed with rejection slips, but the local newspapers had printed 2 or 3. They were inspirational poems, their imagery drawn from Elmer's life as a farmer. "The cows do moo, the lambs do bleat, God's glory walks in on thundering feet." So did Elmer Scales. He had 8 children and an undimmed passion for litigation. Once or twice a year, either partner was summoned out to the Scales farm and Elmer would direct him to a hole in a fence where a hunter or a teenager had cut through his fields. Elmer had often identified these trespassers with his binoculars, and he wanted to sue. They usually managed to talk him out of this, but he always had 2 or 3 litigations of other sorts underway. But this time, Ricky suspected it was more serious than Scales's upsets were normally. He had never before asked, commanded, both partners to come out.
"As you know, Sears," he said, "I can drive and think at the same time. I'm doing a very sedate 30 miles an hour. I think you can trust me with whatever has Elmer worked up."
"Some of his animals died."
Sears said this tight-lipped, implying that his speaking would be likely to result in their going off the road at any minute.
"So why are we going out there? We can't bring them back."
"He wants us to see them. He called Walter Hardesty, too."
"They didn't just die, then?"
"With Elmer, who knows? Now, please, concentrate on getting us there safely, Ricky. This experience will be grisly enough as it is."
Ricky glanced at his partner, and for the first time that morning saw how pale Sears's face was. Beneath the smooth skin, prominent blue veins swam at intervals into visibility. Beneath the young eyes hung gray patches of webbed skin.
"Keep your eyes on the road," said Sears.
"You look terrible."
"I don't think Elmer will notice."
Ricky's eyes were now safely on the narrow country road. This gave him license to speak.
"Did you have a bad night?" Sears said.
"I think it's beginning to melt."
As this was a blatant lie, Ricky ignored it.
"Did you?"
"Observant, Ricky. Yes, I did."
"So did I. Stella thinks we should talk about it."
"Why? Does she have bad nights, too?"
"She thinks that talking about it would help."
"That sounds like a woman. Talking just opens the wounds. Not talking helps to heal them."
"In that case, it was a mistake to invite Donald Wanderley here,"
Sears grunted in exasperation.
"That was unfair of me," Ricky said. "And I'm sorry I said it. But I think we should talk about it for the same reason you think we should invite that boy."
"He's not a boy. He must be 35. He might be 40.
"You know what I mean." Ricky took a deep breath. "Now, I want your forgiveness in advance, because I am going to tell you the dream I had last night. Stella said I woke up screaming. In any case, it was the worst dream yet."
By a shift in the car's inner weather, Ricky knew that Sears was immediately more interested.
"I was in a vacant house on an upper floor, and some mysterious beast was trying to find me. I'll skip the development, but the feeling of danger was overwhelming. At the end of the dream, it came into the room where I was, but it wasn't a monster anymore. It was you and Lewis and John. All of you were dead."
Glancing sideways toward his passenger, he saw the curve of Sears's mottled cheek, the curve of the hat brim.
"You saw the three of us?"
Ricky nodded. Sears cleared his throat, and then cranked the window down a quarter of the way. Freezing air rushed into the car. Sears's chest expanded beneath the black coat. Individual spiky hairs of the furry collar flattened in the rush of air.
"Extraordinary. You say there were the three of us?"
"Yes. Why?"
"Extraordinary. Because I had an identical dream. But when that dreadful thing burst into my room, I saw only two men, Lewis and John. You weren't there."
Ricky heard a tone in the other's voice that took him a moment to identify, and when he had named it, the recognition carried enough surprise to silence him until they turned into Elmer Scales's long driveway. It was Envy.
"Or Virgil," Sears pronounced. To himself, Ricky thought,
as they went slowly up the drive toward the isolated two-story farmhouse. Ricky saw an obviously impatient Scales, dressed in a cap and a plaid jacket, waiting for them on the porch, and saw also that the farmhouse resembled a building in an Andrew Wyeth painting. Scales himself looked like a Wyeth portrait, or, more accurately perhaps, a Norman Rockwell subject. His ears stuck redly out beneath the tied-up flaps of his cap. A gray Dodge sedan was pulled up in the cleared space beside the porch, and when Ricky parked next to it, he saw the sheriff's seal on the door. "Walt's here," he said, and Sears nodded. The two men got out of the car, pulling their coats in tightly around their necks. Scales, now flanked by two shivering children, did not move from the porch. He had the high, hard look of excitement which accompanied his most passionate litigations. His reedy voice called to them.
"About time you two lawyers got here. Walt Hardesty's been here 10 minutes.
"He didn't have as far to come," Sears grumbled. The brim of his hat curled in the unobstructed breeze cutting across the fields.
"Sears, James, I don't suppose any man alive ever got in the last word with you. Hey, you kids, get back in the house. You'll freeze your butts off."
He swatted one with each hand, and the two boys scuttled back inside the door. Scales stood above the two old men, smiling grimly. "What is it, Elmer?" Ricky asked, holding his coat closed at his neck. His feet in his well-shined black shoes were already chilled.
"You'll just have to see. You two town boys aren't really dressed for a walk across the fields. Guess that's your hard luck. Hang on a second, I'll get Hardesty."
He disappeared for a moment into the house and emerged again with the sheriff, Walt Hardesty, who was wearing a loose sheepskin-lined denim coat and a Stetson. Alerted by Scales' remark, Ricky looked at the sheriff's feet. He wore heavy leather hiking boots.
"Mr. James, Mr. Hawthorne," he nodded to them, steam pluming out over his mustache, which was larger and more ragged than Ricky's. In this cattleman's outfit, Hardesty looked 15 years younger than his true age.
"Now that you're here, maybe Elmer will show us what this mystery is all about."
"Damn right I will,"
said the farmer, and clumped down the porch steps and began leading them away from the house, walking on the path toward the snow-dusted barn.
"Just you come this way, gentlemen, and see what I'm going to show you."
Hardesty fell in beside Ricky. Sears was walking alone, with immense dignity, behind them.
"Colder than a bitch," the sheriff said. "Looks like being a damn long winter," Ricky said.
"I hope not. I'm too old for one of those." With exaggerated gestures and an expression like glee on his skinny face, Elmer Scales was unhooking a long rail fence which led into a side pasture.
"Now you pay attention, Walt," he called back. "You see if you can spot any tracks."
He pointed to a line of splayed footprints.
"Them's mine from this morning, going and coming."
The prints returning were widely spaced, as if Scales had been running.
"Where's your notebook? Ain't you going to take notes?"
"Calm down, Elmer," the sheriff said. "I want to see what the problem is first."
"You took notes fast enough when my oldest boy racked up his car."
"Come on, Elmer, show us what you want us to see."
"You town boy's going to ruin your shoes,"
Elmer said.
"Can't be helped. Follow me."
Hardesty did as commanded and set off beside Elmer. His broad back and the bulky coat made the farmer look like a capering boy. Ricky glanced back at Sears, just now approaching the gate, and regarding the snowy field with disgust.
"He might have told us we'd need snowshoes."
"He's enjoying himself," Ricky said wonderingly.
"He'll enjoy himself when I get walking pneumonia and fire a lawsuit at him," Sears muttered. "Since there's no alternative, let's go."
Gamely, Sears put a well-shod foot down into the pasture, where it immediately sank into snow up to the laces.
"Ugh!"
He retracted it, shook it. The others were already halfway across the field.
"I'm not going," Sears said,
jamming his hands into the pockets of his opulent coat.
"Damn it, he can come to the office," Ricky said.
"Well, then I'd better go at least," and started after the other two. Walt Hardesty had turned around to look at them, stroking his ragged mustache. a frontier lawman translated to a snowy field in New York State. He appeared to be smiling. Elmer Scales plodded on oblivious. Ricky picked his way from one footprint to another. Behind him he heard Sears emit enough air to fill a balloon and begin to follow. Single file now, Elmer talking and gesticulating in front, they went across the field. With an odd air of triumphant glee, Elmer stopped at the top of a ridge. Beside him, half covered by snow, were piles of dirty washing. When hardest he reached the low gray piles, he knelt and prodded. Then he grunted, pushing, and Ricky saw four neat black feet roll stiffly into the air. His shoes soaked and his feet wet, Ricky came up to them. Sears, holding his arms out for balance, was still threading toward them, his hat brim flattened by the wind.
"I didn't know you still kept any sheep," he heard Hardesty say.
"I don't now," Scales yelled. "I just had those four, and now they're all gone. Somebody killed them, just kept them around for the sake of the old days. My daddy had a couple hundred, but there's no money in the stupid dang things anymore. The kids liked them, that's all."
Ricky looked down at the four dead animals. Flat on their sides, eyes glazed, snow and the matted wool. Innocent, he asked, "What killed them?"
"Yeah, that's it, ain't it?"
Elmer was working himself up into a tantrum.
"What? Well, you're the law around here, you tell me."
Hardesty, kneeling beside the dirty gray body of the sheep he had rolled over, looked up at Scales with distaste.
"You mean you don't even know if these animals died naturally, Elmer?"
I know.
Scales lifted his arms dramatically, a bat in flight.
"How do you know?"
"Because nothing can kill a damn sheep, that's how I know. And what the hell would kill four at once? Heart attacks, boy!"
Sears now joined them, his frame making the kneeling Hardesty look small.
"Four dead sheep," he said, looking down. "I suppose you want to sue them."
"What? You found the lunatic who did this and sue his ass off."
"And who would that be?"
"Dunno. But..."
"Yeah?"
Hardesty looked up again from the sheep huddled at his knees.
"I'll tell you inside. Meantime, Mr. Sheriff, you look him over good and take notes and find out what he did to him."
"He?"
"Inside."
Hardesty, scowling, was probing the carcass.
"You want the vet for this, Elmer, not me."
His hands moved to the animal's neck.
"Uh-oh."
"What?"
said Scales, almost leaping with anticipation. Instead of answering, Hardesty crab-walked to the next nearest sheep and thrust his hands deep into the wool at its neck.
"You might have seen this for yourself," he said, and gripping its nose and mouth, pulled back the sheep's head.
"Jesus!"
said Scales. The two lawyers were silent. Ricky looked down at the exposed wound, like a wide mouth, the long slash in the animal's neck.
"A neat job," Hardesty said. "A very neat job of work." "Okay, Elmer, you proved your point. Let's get back inside."
He wiped his fingers in the snow.
"Jesus!"
Elmer repeated.
"Their throats are cut, all of them?"
Wearily, Hardesty yanked back the heads of each remaining animal.
"All of them."
Old voices spoke clearly in Ricky's mind. He and Sears looked at each other, looked away.
"I'll sue the heart out of whoever did this,"
Elmer screeched.
"Shit! I knew something was funny. I knew it! Shit!"
Hardesty was now looking around at the empty field.
"You sure you went up here once and then went straight back?"
"Uh-huh."
"How did you know something was wrong?"
"Because I saw him up here this morning from the window. Normally, when I'm washing my face at my window, them stupid animals is the first thing I see. See?"
He pointed across the fields to his house. The shining pane of the kitchen window faced them.
"There's grass under here. They just walk around all day stuffing themselves. When the snow gets real bad, I pin 'em up in the barn. I just looked out and I saw 'em, like they are now. Something sure was wrong, so I put on my coat and my boots and came up. Then I called you and my lawyers. I want to sue, and I want you to arrest whoever done this."
"There aren't any tracks besides ours," Hardesty said, smoothing his mustache.
"I know," said Scales. "He brushed him out."
"Could be. But you can usually tell on unbroken snow."
"Jesus, she moved. She can't. She's dead."
"And there's another thing," said Ricky, breaking into the suspicious silence which had developed between the two men and interrupting the lunatic voice in his mind.
"There's no blood."
For a moment, all four men stared down at the sheep and the fresh snow. It was true.
"Can we get off this step now?" Sears said. Elmer was still staring down at the snow, swallowing. Sears began to move across the field, and soon they were all following.
"All right, kids, out of the kitchen. Get upstairs,"
Scales shouted as they came into the house and removed their coats.
"We gotta talk in private. Go on, get."
He shot his hands at some of the children who were clustered in the hallway, staring at Walter Hardesty's pistol.
"Sarah, Mitchell, upstairs now."
He led them into the kitchen, and a woman as thin as Elmer shot up out of a chair, clasping her hands.
"Mr. James, Mr. Hawthorne," she said, "could you use some coffee?"
"Kitchen toweling, if you please, Mrs. Scales," Sears said, "then coffee."
"Kitchen?"
"To wipe my shoes. Mr. Hawthorne undoubtedly requires the same service."
The woman looked down in dismay at the lawyer's shoes.
"Oh, good heavens. Here, let me help you."
She took a roll of paper toweling from a cupboard, tore off a long section, and made as if to kneel at Sears's feet.
"That won't be necessary,"
Sears said, taking the wadded paper from her hands. Only Ricky knew that Sears was disturbed, not merely rude.
"Mr. Hawthorne?"
A bit rattled by Sears's coldness, the woman turned to Ricky.
"Yes, thank you, Mrs. Scales," he said. "That's very kind of you."
He too accepted several sections of the toweling.
"Their throats were cut," Elmer said to his wife. "What did I tell you? Some crazy man's been out here." "And," his voice rose, "a crazy man who can fly, because he didn't leave no prints."
"Tell them," his wife said.
Elmer looked at her sharply, and she hurried off to put the coffee together. Hardesty asked,
"Tell us what?"
No longer in the Wyatt Earp costume, the sheriff was restored to his proper age of 50.
"He's hitting the bottle worse than ever," Ricky thought, seeing the broken veins in Hardesty's face, the deepening irresolution.
For the truth was, despite his Texas Ranger appearance, the hawk nose, lined cheeks, and gunslinger blue eyes, Walt Hardesty was too lazy to be a good sheriff. It was typical of him that he had had to be told to look at the second pair of sheep. And Elmer Scales was right. He should have taken notes. Now the farmer was preening himself, about to deliver his bombshell. Stringy cords stood out in his neck. His bat ears went a deeper shade of red.
"Well, hell, I saw him, didn't I?"
His mouth dropped comically, and he surveyed each of them in turn.
"Him?"
his wife said, in ironic counterpoint behind him.
"Shit, woman, what else?"
Scales thumped the table.
"Get that coffee ready and stop interrupting."
He turned back to the three men.
"As big as me. Bigger. Staring at me. Damnedest thing you ever saw."
Enjoying his moment, he spread his arms.
"Right outside. Just a little further than that, away from me. How's them apples?"
"Did you recognize him?" Hardesty asked.
"Didn't see him that well. Now, I'll tell you how it was."
He was moving around the kitchen, unable to contain himself, and Ricky was reminded of an old perception that our Virgil wrote poetry because he was too volatile to believe he was not capable of it.
"I was in here last night, late, couldn't sleep, never could."
"Never could,"
echoed his wife. Screeches, thumps came from overhead.
"Forget the coffee and get on upstairs, straighten them out,"
Scales said. He paused while she left the room. Soon another voice joined the cacophony above, then the noises ceased.
"Like I said, I was in here reading through a couple 2-3 equipment and seed catalogs. Then I hear something from out near the barn. Prowler! Damn! I jumps up and looks out the window. Seen it was snowing. Uh-oh, work to do tomorrow, I says to myself. Then I seen him by the barn. Well, between the barn and the house."
"What did he look like?" Hardesty said, still not taking notes.
"Couldn't tell. Too dark."
His voice had soared from alto to soprano.
"Just saw him there staring."
"You saw him in the dark?" Sears asked in a bored voice. "Were your yard lights on?"
"Mr. Lawyer, you gotta be kidding. With electric bills the way they are? No. But I saw him, and I knew he was big."
"Now, how did you know that, Elmer?" asked Hardesty.
Mrs. Scales was coming down the uncarpeted stairs, thump, 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 hard shoes hitting the wooden risers. Ricky sneezed. A child began to whistle, and abruptly ceased as the footsteps paused.
"Because I saw his eyes, didn't I? Just staring out at me, about 6 feet above the ground."
"You just saw his eyes?" asked Hardesty, incredulous. "What the hell did this guy's eyes do, Elmer, shine in the dark?"
"You said it,"
Elmer replied. Ricky jerked his head to look at Elmer, who regarded them all with evident satisfaction, and then, without meaning to, looked across the table at Sears. He had gone tense and immobile at Hardesty's last question, trying to let nothing show on his face. And on Sears's round face, he saw the same intention.
"Sears, too. It means something to him, too."
"Now, I expect you to get him, Walt, and you two lawyers of mine to sue his ass from here to summer,"
Elmer said conclusively.
"Excuse my language, honey."
His wife was coming into the little kitchen again, and she nodded at his apology, acknowledging its rectitude by tapping it with her chin as it went by, before taking the percolator off the burner.
"Did you see anything last night, Mrs. Scales?" Hardesty asked.
Ricky saw a similar recognition in Sears's eyes and knew that he had given himself away.
"All I saw was a scared husband," she said. "I suppose that's the part he left out."
Elmer cleared his throat. His Adam's apple bobbed.
"Well, it looked funny."
"Yes," Sears said. "I think we know all we need to know. Now, if you'll excuse us, Mr. Hawthorne and I must be getting back to town."
"You'll drink your coffee first, Mr. James," said Mrs. Scales, putting a steaming plastic cup down before him on the tabletop. "If you're going to sue some monster's ass from here to summer, you'll need your strength."
Ricky forced himself to smile, but Walt Hardesty guffawed. Outside, Hardesty, back in the protective coloration of his Texas Ranger outfit, bent over to speak softly through the 3-inch crack Sears had opened in the window.
"Are you two going back into town? Could we meet somewhere to have a word or two? Is it important?"
"Might be."